continuing in Mitzvah Shin Chav Dalet 324, Mitzvahs Netilas Lulav, the Mitzvah to take the Lulav and Esrog Mishorshia, Mitzvah, the reasoning behind the Mitzvah is as follows. Hakdama. I'm going to give you an introduction. Farkasavti lach b'ni kama pamim, b'mashe kadam, she'adam nifal kifi pulosav she'aseh tamid. So your actions have an impact on how you react to things, how you think about things. V'rayonav... that your ideas, anything that goes on in your head, is highly impacted by what you do with your hands. Im tov im ra, whether good or bad. In order to increase the merit of the Jewish people, that God gave us many mitzvot. That since you're going to do a lot of actions that are directed towards God, so it's going to have a positive impact on your thought processes. And miklal ha-mitzvos shetzivanu lahasiz machshavtenu ba'avodaso betara hi mitzvos ha-tfilin. So he says that lulav and esrog is somewhat analogous to the mitzvah of tfilin. Liyosan munachin keneged evari ha-adam hayeduim bo lemishkan ha-seichel v'hem alev ha-moach. The two organs that are known as the dwelling place of one's intellect and very humanity is the heart and the brain. Okay, nowadays in contemporary anatomy, and we would limit that to the brain, but the heart figuratively is the part of the body that you know it in your heart. You know, we use the heart as figuratively, meaning that it's part of the spiritual and intellectual heart of a person.
Now I'll probably say two types of nervous system or something like this, because you have the thought process, and then you have inside you have the emotions, right? And both are part of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So does
very
that
good
mean that if you want to use somebody else's tefillin, you kind of have to rent it or buy it or give them some contribution, mm-hmm, because they're supposed to be your own?
Like the lulav? No, there's no rule. That rule is only by the lulav. That on the first day of Sukkot.
You know, you don't.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's no rule that the tefillin you have to actually own. Umitoch polozet tamid yiyached kol machshevosav letov. So you're gonna have in mind, you have these two things sitting on you that remind you of God all the time. And of course, there's also an element of arm that he'll discuss, I'm sure, when we get to the mitzvah of tefillin, that the arm does stuff. So, you know, when you're doing stuff, you should have in mind God when you're doing things with your hands. But it's on your arm and on by your heart. So it's a dual purpose thing, the mitzvah of tefillin. And it's constantly supposed to remind you that your thoughts should be subjugated to God.
Quite a bit of ownership, actually. You know, for example, with a talus, so maybe you make a bracha on talus. You get a talus from a shul, you make a bracha because it's assumed that, you know, it doesn't belong to you, but it's there for you. Is there any, in cases where, in fact, you're using somebody else's lulav, like the old days when you're not everybody could afford to get their own lulav?
Mm-hmm. The same thing.
You didn't have to have a kavanah that you don't need to be having a kinyan or anything of that sort.
No, you do. I mean, you do with the talus also. Yeah. It's just that when the congregation buys a lulav, the same way as when the congregation buys a talus, the assumption is it's bought with the intention that everybody can acquire it when they want and then give it back.
Right.
It's just an automatic assumption. So the same thing, too. When the whole congregation buys one set of lulav and esrog, then the assumption is that the congregation goes around, they acquire it, and then they give it to the next person.
So when you pick it up, that's...
The Yizkor V'Yizar Tamid Kol Hayom L'Chavin Kol Masav B'Yosher V'Tzedek. All the things that you should be with honesty and justice. Uchmochein Mitzvahs HaLulav Im Shloshes Minav. The mitzvah of the lulav with the other three species. Mizeh Shoreshu. It's the same reasoning over here. L'Fish Yemei Achag Hem Yemei Simcha Gedola LiYisrael. That during the festival of Sukkot and Shemini Atzeres, those are the happiest days of the year for the Jewish people. That's the time when everything is done, all the agricultural season is finished, it's about to be the winter, and you're rejoicing in the bountiful harvest that God has given you, and you now have the opportunity to bring this harvest into your house. That's just the happiest time of Neke Nikra Chag Ha'asiv, the time of ingathering. The festival in gathering. That's why God said we should make a holiday at that time of year. That at a time when people are naturally very happy, they should channel that happiness towards God and the worship of God. That when people get extremely happy, so they get caught up in their happiness and joy, so sometimes they might forget God, and there might be very into their materialistic excesses. So that's why the Rambam famously says that if you have your fancy meals and you're eating your meat and you're drinking wine and you're like, oh, Simchas Yontif, Gevaldik, this is the joy of Yontif, but you don't invite people to join you in the holiday meals, who might not otherwise have a place to go, then that he calls that a Simchas Kreso, the joy of one's belly, as opposed to a true joy, which comes from, again, sharing in God's bounty with others and channeling that joy to worship a God. So the same thing over here is we want to channel the natural joy that we feel during the time of the ingathering of the harvest. Well, we don't really gather our harvest, so... Okay.
Get our paycheck.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The Goyim, they have Oktoberfest. It's also gathering to the harvest, but basically.
Yeah.
But then they drink beer and they do all the stuff.
Beer sounds good.
Yeah, well, you're allowed to drink beer on Sukkot too if you want. So
they do other things which you're not allowed.
Right. Okay. Fine. So tzivanu Hashem lakachas bein yadeinu. So since we might forget God during our intense joy at this time, so A, he commanded us to have a holiday in general, and B, we have to take in our hands dvarim hamazkirim osanu. That all the simcha, the point of the lulav, according to Sefer HaChinuch, is to remind us that the joy should be channeled to God. So these things are supposed to be things that bring joy. Just like it's a joyous time of year. Everything God said is correct and just. That these four species are particularly beautiful. So therefore, if you look at this gorgeous bundle of foliage and this gorgeous, bright, yellow, nicely shaped fruit, so you're going to have natural joy by the visual stimulation of seeing these pretty things in your hands. Oh, and you always say Judaism is not visually visual culture. Here we go. Visual beauty is important in Judaism. Okay. Ve'od yesh barba minim elu inyan acher. There's another thing about these. Shem domim le'evarim sheba'adam hayakarim. That they're similar to human body parts. Sheha esrog domil alev. The esrog looks like a heart. Shehu Mishkan HaSeichel, which again, according to Sefer HaChinuch, is the dwelling place of reason and intellect. Lirmos Sheyavod Baru B'Sichlo. So you're supposed to serve God with all your heart, and he interprets this to mean, again, the intellect. V'halulav Domela Shidra. The lulav is similar to the spine. Shehi HaIkar Sheba Adam. That's the root from which the rest of the body comes out. It's like the... Everything is anchored to the spine. Lirmos sheyasher kol gufo lavodoso baruchu. You should straighten your body, and you should the root of your body should be the worship of God. The hahadas domelainayim, the myrtle leaves think they look like this, right? Sort of.
Yeah.
So myrtle leaves look like eyes. Lirames shelo yosur achar eina biyom simchas lubo. You shouldn't think, you're so happy. Sometimes you look around looking for other things to do. Your eyes start to rove. And the lulav is supposed to remind you that your eyes should not rove, but rather be focused inwards again on the divine service. The arava domela svasayim. The willow looks like lips, has longer leaves than the hadas. Lirmos sheyasim resen befiv vichavein. Dvarav, that you should put a bridle on your mouth, a muzzle, and you should be careful about what you say. V'yira me'ashem af beis ha'simcha. You should fear God even at the time of joy. We know that certain times, yontif meals, everyone's gathered together. Of course, there's some drink that's been had, and sometimes people's tongues get looser than perhaps they should be. So the arava is supposed to remind you not to be too loose with your lips and to keep a lid on certain things that should not be said all year long. and should not certainly not be let out in such a joyous and spiritual time as Sukkot.
Yeah, but the Esrog and Lulav and Aros are usually put in the refrigerator, otherwise they will. So you don't have them in front of you.
You don't. But the Gemara tells us that Anshe Yerushalayim, that the really pious people who lived in Yerushalayim, used to hold the lulav and esrog all day long.
I mean, they eat one-handed.
How
they
ever get anything done? Eat, right.
The wives get it done. They're not responsible.
Oh, I guess so.
Okay. But they, it's the same, it's a similar idea, you know, not exactly the same halachically, but it's a similar concept to the fact that really tefillin are supposed to be worn all day long. And the lulav and esrog are also in an ideal world supposed to be held on all day long. It's a little bit different because really there's a specific mitzvah to wear tefillin all the time. So limiting it to shacharis is a bit of a chiddush. We'll discuss when we get the mitzvah of tefillin, why we do that. But the lulav and esrog, really it's just a mitzvah to take them once a day, and then it's just some sort of like a midas chasidus or mitzvah mina muvchar, a pious practice to hold them all day long. But there is a sort of a kiyum mitzvah to hold the lulav and esrog all day long. Some people suggest that the reason that it says specifically that Anshe Yerushalayim, the people lived in Jerusalem, used to do this is because, like the Shita Sarambam we were discussing last time, that the mitzvah of lulav and esrog, even in the rest of Yerushalayim, not just in the Beis HaMikdash, is a mitzvah deraisa all 7 days. Others say not like that. The Vilna Gaon, it says, used to do this. He used to hold even in Vilna. Everybody agrees. There's no that the mitzvah of lulav and esrog midaraisa is only one day in Vilna, and the rest are in the rest and the rest of Sukkot is only the Rabbanan. Nevertheless, the Vilna Gaon used to do this, that he would hold the lulav and esrog literally all day long.
But Vilna was Yerushalayim, I thought.
Yeah. Oh, Yerushalayim Shalita. Yerushalayim Shalita, yeah. Okay, but
he doesn't put it down and cut his food.
I mean, the fact that you use both hands to hold the lulav and esrog, alpi pashtus is not the ma'akev. That if you right, that the preferable way to hold the lulav and esrog, we all know, is that the lulav is in your right hand and the esrog is in your left hand. Switch that for lefties. According to many shitas,
switch it for lefties.
Mm-hmm. Not everybody agrees to that, but that's the normal psak. So so that's a mitzvah min hamuvchar. So that they fulfilled during davening, and for the rest of the day, probably they just held it with one hand. You know, the only one had to turn the pages of the sefer he was reading. You know, unless you, I don't know. Okay, but you could manage. You know, holding. It's like if you have a baby, you're holding a baby all day long, so you have managed to get stuff done with just one hand. Okay.
Get one of those.
Yeah, but you can't do that for the love. V'tam she'eino noheg b'medina elo yom echad. Why? Oh, so before we get to this, actually, so we should mention that it's interesting that the Sefer Chinuch doesn't bring the famous medrash about what the significance behind the lulav and esrog is. That it represents the unity and the inseparability of the entire Jewish people. That what is an esrog? Esrog has taste and smell. It smells good and it tastes good. So those represent the people who learn Torah and they do good deeds. Then you have the Arava, which has neither taste nor smell, the willow, and that represents the people who have neither Torah nor good deeds. And then the Hadas and the Lulav each have, one has taste and no smell, that's the Lulav, that it produces dates. And then the Hadas smells good, but it produces no good taste. So therefore, those represent the people who either learn Torah and have no good deeds, or the people who do good deeds and don't learn Torah. So you need all these four groups of people to come together, especially on holidays, in order for us to have a complete simcha. So we shouldn't shut anyone out from our joyous occasion, that it's pleasing to God when we're all held together in one bundle, so to speak. So you can ask on that. There's a famous question on that. So why is the esrog outside the bundle? Why is the esrog outside the bundle?
You can't do it, it'll fall out.
The esrog is not in the bundle because the esrog represents the really super pious people who learn Torah and do good deeds. So they you know, they when you have the mitzvah, they come together with the rest of the people
they
who are on lower level. But
the
then they need to separate easily. They can't stay together all the time. So the other three, they're mamish together in one bundle. We don't want to tie the really high level people together with the lower level people mamish together. Oh, so that's also our focus on the Arava, by the way, is something that the Sefer Chinuch does not mention explicitly, but there's an ancillary mitzvah that Arava gets its own attention, even though it has no taste and no smell. So the Arava gets its own attention because we know we have a received tradition from the Nevi'im, always, that some sort of Alach al-Moshe Mi-Sinai, some very, very ancient tradition, although not mentioned explicitly in the Chumash, that there's a separate mitzvah to take an Arava, just by itself, a willow branch, during the 7 days of Sukkot in the Beis HaMikdash. They used to take the Arava every day during Sukkot, and they used to walk around the Mizbeach, the altar. They used to walk around the altar with the Arava, which forms the basis for our ceremony nowadays that we have the Hoshanos, that we take the, we have these piyutim that we have, and we say the piyutim while holding the Lulav and Esrog. We don't do the Arava every day anymore, but we take the Lulav and Esrog and we walk around the Bima, which represents the Mizbeach, and you take the Sefer Torah on the Bima, so it should be more holy at that time, more representing of the altar, and we walk around every day with a Lulav and Esrog saying Hoshanas. And the only time where we reminisce to the exact minhag which is done in the Beis HaMikdash is on the seventh day. On the seventh day, so even we nowadays take an Arava separately, and we don't walk around with it. Again, there is a shita that you do walk around with it on Hoshana Rabbah, but the normal custom is that we do not walk around with the Arava on Hoshana Rabbah. We lift up the Arava, and we take the Arava. And it says in the Gemara that when it describes the ceremony on the seventh day of Sukkot, of taking just the Arava in reminiscence of the Beis HaMikdash, so it says that one of the Amoraim used to chavit, and he didn't make a bracha. He didn't make a bracha because it was only a minag nevi'im. It was a custom of the prophets, but not an actual takana. So he didn't make a bracha, but he used to do chavit. So what does chavit mean? Etuah pshatim. The simpler intuitive understanding is like Rashi, that you think is like Rashi. That Rashi says that he shook it like the lulav. That he took the arava and he shook it like the lulav. But the Rambam and many Rishonim say that he whacked it on the floor. So when in Judaism do you ever find taking mitzvah articles and whacking them on the floor? It's very strange. It's a very unique ceremony, so that's why we do both. That when you lift up the, we do like Rashi, and then like the Rambam, when you first take up the Arava during the longer Hoshana Piyutim on Hoshana Rabbah, you're supposed to shake it a little bit, and then when you get to the end, so you whack it on the floor like the Rambam. Okay. Fine. V'tam... continues the Sefer Achinuch. Tam she'eino noeg b'medina elo yom echad lefi she'adua ki ikra simcha b'yom rishanu. That in the rest of the world, it's only there. The Mida Raisa, there's only lulav on the first day of Sukkot, because the first day is the main time when we're getting into gear, and that's when we need the most reminding. We're getting into gear. We're the happiest. The Sukkot is upon us. Yes. So we need to have the reminder right then and there. So, but the rest of the rest of Sukkot and the Beis HaMikdash is just as joyous as the first day in everywhere else, because we have during the rest of Sukkot, we have the Korbanos, so you have a more intense level of Simcha in the Beis HaMikdash, but you also have the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. Which again, the Simchas Beis HaShoeva is a ceremony that's connected to the Nisuch HaMayim, the water libation on the altar, which again is something that's also not mentioned in the Torah explicitly, but is one of those received traditions we have about Sukkot, Halach HaMoshe Mi-Sinai. So when they used to draw the water, connected to the drawing of the water for the water libation, they had a very big party. Simchas Beis HaShoeva, every night of Sukkot, except for Shabbos and Yom Tov, they used to have Simchas Beis HaShoeva, they used to have torches, they used to have dancing, but it says that who would be doing the dancing? The tzaddikim. The leaders of the rabbis, they would be dancing joyously, and the rest of the people would just come and watch. It reminds you kind of Chassidus HaSimchas Torah. Chassidus HaSimchas Torah, the Rebbe has a tish, and the Rebbe dances with a Sefer Torah, and everybody just watches. I mean, nowadays, I'm sure they might have after parties or pre-parties where everybody dances the Sefer Torah, but the main Simchas Torah... Okay.
And the women watch.
Well, okay, well, that's true. You're right. All men dance with a Sefer Torah. But the main Simchas Torah celebration by the Chassidim is watching the Rebbe dance, based on this idea. And this is also the source, the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, for the Mechitza. This is the quintessential source for the Mechitza, that it says that when they saw that there was too much intermingling between the men and the women, so they constructed a balcony for the women.
The men.
Well, as a source for the Mechitza, that they constructed a balcony in order to separate the genders. So that's the source that, based on other Gemaras also, that talk about how even in times of sadness, when there's a hesped, you know, you have to separate men and women. So Kol Shekhen, you have to separate men and women when there's a joyous occasion or a spiritual occasion like davening.
But yeah. That was the time they separated them. It meant that the rest of the time, up until then at least, there was mingling in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, mingling of men and women.
Correct. There's no separate. Mm-hmm. Correct.
And now you go to a wedding, you can't possibly go into the same entrance as the men. I mean,
in some places.
In most places.
There's separate entrances. No,
yeah.
What?
Not most places.
Many places.
In her circles, that's what she's used to, perhaps.
Many places,
okay.
Separate entrances.
Okay, so we can discuss exactly in which situations a mechitza is required.
How can they construct it like a... Maybe make a change in the architecture of
it was temporary. I mean, look at that. It's just, you know.
Okay, all right.
They rolled out the bleachers.
But that's why a lot of people prefer, when you have a shul, to have a women's balcony as opposed to again, it's not necessarily a halachic issue, but based on the original setup, that a women's balcony, also, if you think about it practically, so unless you have a really stark mechitza, so a women's balcony is often, usually, always, more successful at actually preventing intermingling than the mechitza, than a mechitza like we have in our shul, which is, you know, sort of semi-transparent on the top.
There isn't any intermingling.
We're able to mingle in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash. Do we worry so much about this kind of mechitza or that kind of mechitza? If it was okay for the Beis HaMikdash, why do we have to...
Look, I'm not saying... I'm not saying that there's a strict... prohibition of any type of mingling. That's why it's many shuls in Brooklyn at a kiddush, it's separate. Even at a shul kiddush after davening, and our shul is not separate. Okay. You have to realize the different communal standards above these things, which are not necessarily based in strict halacha, but they feel that they want what they consider to be a higher level of separation of men and women, so there shouldn't be any type of temptation or question, or as far-fetched as we might think it is, but...
And until I guess, nearly the 20th century, you know, non-Jews, you know, churches, they had separate seating.
They did?
Yeah,
they did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. There was no such thing as, you know, like family pews or something like that. Until,
that's right. Okay. And the same thing in shuls.
And
that
Reform also, by the way. You know, Reform shuls in the 19th century, they had separate seating, so...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're
that
from, right?
Protestants, too?
Huh?
I think so.
Yeah, no, they're copying Protestants.
Evangelicals, too? I looked this up.
Well, you have...
We copied what was going on in the churches. We just wanted to be like the Christians in their churches.
You mean the Reform?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, in the shuls also, you have different approaches regarding how stark the mechitza has to be, the different shittas. Mm-hmm. Again... You have to deduce these things from the classical sources because they're not explicit. It never says anywhere, Hilchos Mechitza has to be this way. Well, it was just an assumption of Gantz Kal Yisrael that this was part of synagogue architecture from all time based on this based on this issue in the Beis HaMikdash, so we assume that has halachic status.
But I mean, Mechitza is a sort of fucking, though. You know that from...
So you paskin like Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav Soloveitchik had apparently said that Me'ikr Hadin, according to the strict halacha, a mechitza in shul simply needed to follow the rules of mechitza for all the Torah, which is that has to be 10 tefachim high. That's like when you want to surround something to be able to carry there on Shabbos, so the mechitza has to be 10 tefachim high, about a meter, about a meter high. And yeah, you could imagine that according to that, so lovud works too. So you have, you know, poles or strings, you know, less than 3 tefachim up to a height of a meter. So that works as a mechitza in shul. Yeah, that's not going to prevent much intermingling. So that's why. Again, that was Rav Soloveitchik's shita. So that a lot of shuls, more of the more modern type that perhaps were considering whether or not to have a mechitza at all, in, you know, the 60s, for example, had a mechitza that was very low. So you walk in the now, there's like, where's the mechitza? Oh.
There it is.
So, right.
They made mechitza out of plants. They put like plants.
Right. So that's that follows the shita of Rav Soloveitchik. I don't know if he held that was the ideal, but he held that strictly speaking that according to halacha, the mechitza and shul just needed to follow the rules of mechitza for kol haTorah.
It's claimed that actually he went into Lincoln Square. After,
yeah.
After Rav Riskin, got them to put in a mechitza, and he said, okay, it's kosher, but I wouldn't daven here.
Did he say that?
I mean, there's an issue of...
That sounds like urban legend.
Well, it could be. It wasn't for halachic reasons. There are other. If that was the only shul available, so perhaps you would have davened there. But again, I wouldn't recommend to anyone in general to daven in a shul that has a. If you have a choice, if you're invited to a bar mitzvah, if that's the only shul in town, so, okay. So
also, it's a circle, and I mean, there are other issues there.
Right. There are other issues, but I wouldn't recommend choosing to daven if all other things are equal to choosing to daven in a shul like that. Certainly not.
No, but it's only physical interaction, so there's no reason why mechitza couldn't be cleared less.
I thought there was a disagreement.
Oh, so Ramosha Feinstein. So we normally, the normative psak in centrist orthodoxy, it follows Ramosha Feinstein, which is that basically the mechitza has to be shoulder high, because that's what he felt prevented intermingling. Mm-hmm. But he said that the top part could be semi see through, like we have here. As these mechitzas seem to be custom designed in order to follow Ramosha Feinstein's opinion, that the top part could be clear because. If it's better to have, opaque from the shoulder down or from a certain point down. So, if the women are not properly dressed, so then the men shouldn't be able to see it. But if the women don't cover their hair, so nowadays it's not so bad since women are very used to seeing women with uncovered hair. So therefore, you don't have to be so makbet on the top part, but you should be makbet to have an opaque lower part. So that's the compromise sheet again. You can't look in Shulchan Aruch and say, oh, yes, that's where how we have to make a mechitza, because there are a lot of things that were just an assumed part of Jewish life that don't have their own set of rules. But we normally follow Rav Moshe Feinstein's compromise opinion. And then, of course, you have the opinion of the Hungarians who very much insisted on this. You know, in Hungary, it was everybody did this, but when it was a big chiddush in America at the time, when there was the real Hungarian influx around World War II, that they insisted that the mechitza had to prevent the men from seeing the women at all. So they held that if you have a balcony, you have to have a veil above the balcony, so you can't the men can't see the women at all. And if you have a mechitza, well, you could have one-way glass in theory.
Yeah.
But if you have a mechitza that's a one level, it's just a mechitza, then it has to be high enough that the men and women cannot see each other at all. I mean, the women could see the men in theory, but the women cannot see the men. So that's the more extreme opinion. But a lot of shuls, even regular Ashkenazi, Lithuanian shuls in Brooklyn, sort of, and Muncie, have adopted this approach because it's viewed as frimmer. So don't be surprised if you walk into a shul and you see a mechitza that's constructed in this manner. There's a story, an interesting story, in the biography of Rav Breuer. It says that, some Farfrumta person at Breuer's once came to Rav Breuer to complain that why is he so lenient about the mechitza? If you look upstairs, you can see the women, and we know that it's better to have a mechitza where you can't see the women at all. So he asked if he could add a thick veil to the top of the mechitza of the women's balcony. Remember, in those days, there was only the balcony. There was not the little women's section downstairs. If he could add a veil to the balcony to prevent the men from seeing the women at all. So Rav Breuer answered, yes, you could do that, but on one condition. So the man said, oh, great, okay, what's the condition? He says, you have to tell your wife that she must stop wearing a sheitel, and she has to cover her hair with a thick veil.
Instant all around.
Anyway, okay.
I was living in Tannersville, I believe, where the mechitza, which was set up by Rav Breuer, in fact, that some of the firmer elements and they went ahead in the middle of the night and they sort of made it higher. But then the question was, we can't become less firm now. Like, restoring to what Rav Breuer said, though.
Yeah, it's a problem. Okay. But the shul has to decide what makes sense for their community.
Or
Okay. Not neither way. Again, Ramosha's way, you can't say Ramosha's way is wrong. You can't say the Hungarian way is wrong. Different different standards, different community. Okay, the Hungarians would say Ramosha's way is wrong. That's one of the things they complained about there. Moshe Feinstein is introducing all these kulas in American Judaism. He allows non-Chol of Yisrael. He allows mechitzas that are lower. It's one of their complaints against, why does everybody, think of him as the Posek Ador? But he knew what was going on, and he knew it was appropriate, and he knew it was halachically sanctioned. Okay. V'tam she'enu nog b'medin al yom echad v'vi she'edua ki ikar ha'simcha b'yom rishon. Okay, the main joy is on the first day. V'im tishal, maybe you'll ask the question. Shmini atzeres she'esh bo simcha gedola li Yisrael. The Shmini atzeres is an even more joyous day than the preceding part of the holiday, which is called Sukkot. Lama lo haya nitalba. Why don't you take the lulav on Shmini Atzeres? We discussed before why you don't take the lulav on Shmini Atzeres because of the sveika dioma. Okay, hachuva kiyom Shmini Atzeres kulo Hashem. We don't want anything interfering with us directly focused on God on Shmini Atzeres. No external trappings. Just a pure regular yantif. No lulav. No sukkah. Okay, now we have a sukkah because of the problem of the sveika dioma. But it should just be a regular yontif. Everyone is in their house with no external trappings of other mitzvos, just focusing a yontif on us and God. Of course, nowadays we have a lot of external trappings. We have we have Simchas Torah. We have the sukkah on the first day. In Judaism, we can't let well enough alone. We can't just have regular yomim tovim. We need to impose more rituals. Shavuos, 2,000 years ago, Shavuos was just a regular holiday. There was no milchiks, there was no, staying up all night learning. It was just everybody got to enjoy a nice day off from work. And okay, you read about Kriyas HaTorah, giving of the Torah in the morning. Shmini Atzeres, 2,000 years ago, was a regular nice yantif. Everybody just could hang out, or not at home necessarily, but the base in Yerushalayim, whatever. Everybody just could spend a nice day at home with their family, learning Torah maybe, whatever. But now we have... Again, if you're into it, I'm not knocking it, but we have these imposed things that are not part of the original observance of the holiday, because again, we have some sort of aversion to just regular holidays.
I think part of
But Golos is different from living in Eretz Yisrael. Yeah, you need more focus. Fine. What do we know about Shmini Atzeres? It's like the king who made a party for his servants. It's hard for me to separate from you, and I want you to separate from me, so therefore, I want you to stay with me an extra day. That we were supposed to be so focused on God and how he wanted us to stay an extra day on after Sukkot, on first Shmini Atzeres, that we don't need these external reminders. Oh, so why don't we take the lulav on Pesach? We don't need the lulav. Sha'arei, we have other external mitzvah things. Sha'arei matzah u'maror v'gufo shel Pesach ben yodav. So right in front of you, you have matzah. Again, we're talking about the first day, because again, midaraisa, the lulav is also only the first day. So that sets the tone for the entire Pesach. You have these reminders, the physical reminders of the matzah, the maror, and the paschal offering, or two of the three nowadays. It's not a time of intense joy. It's a time of reflection. It's a time of memory. It's a time of contentment. But it's not a time of active joy in the same way that Sukkot is. Again, a little bit, but...
Nobody eats maror the rest of the days of Pesach, though. Wine and matzah, yes.
No, because maror midaraisa is... the reason that maror midaraisa is only when there's korban Pesach. Yeah, nowadays, maror is derabanan. Mm-hmm. So we have it at the Seder as a remembrance, but matzah is 7 days. You have to eat matzah.
The
concept of matzah is 7 days for midaraisa, yeah. Bechaga Shavuos, gamken, ein tzarech hazkara acheres. You don't need anything else on Shavuos. Ki ikar regel, einu ala mitzad matan Torah seinu. Should be so focused on the giving of the Torah that you shouldn't need any other reminder again. But that's also, in the Torah, it's described also with agricultural significance. And the Torah, the giving of the Torah, is not even mentioned explicitly in the Torah. But yes, the Sefer Chinuch's Mahalach, which he told us when we were talking about Shavuos also, is that the etzem mahus, the main point of this day, is talking about the giving of the Torah.
Yeah, but so was it called the Tzeres of Pesach? So it is
right. It's connected with Pesach also. Yeah,
the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. So to remember the giving of the Torah on Shavuos, so then we will straighten our ways, and we won't have to have the Lulav to remind us. This is what we, I think, is the reasoning behind the mitzvah of Lulav based on the simple level. However, al pi Kabbalah, in Jewish mystical thought, there is perhaps an even deeper level of understanding of what the Lulav and the Esrog are for. And if you want to learn more about that, so the Ramban mentions a little bit in his commentary on the Chumash, he talks about the Kabbalistic ideas behind these things. Dinei HaMitzvah, the laws of the mitzvah are as follows. Masha Amru Zichron Livracha, Sharba Aminim Elu Mitzvah Achas Hein. They're one mitzvah. Ma'akvin zezeh b'she'enlo. That if you are lacking one of the species, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah. You didn't fulfill three quarters of a mitzvah or half a mitzvah, depending on how many you have, it's zero. Aval ein im yeshlo netalan bezeh harzeh, yotza dekaimelon lulav ein tzarech eged. But if you take them one after the other, you take the lulav, then you put it down, you take the hadas, then you take the arava, then you take the ezrog, so you are yotze because you took lamaitza, all four of the minim, on the first day or the other days of Sukkot. Because there is an opinion in the Tanoim, Rabbi Yehuda holds, lulav tzarech eged, that you have to tie the lulav together with the hadasim and the aravos in order to fulfill the mitzvah. However, we don't paskin like that, but we do hold that it's a mitzvah min hamufchar. It's preferable to follow the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Therefore, everybody's minhag is we actually do tie the three species together in order to fulfill the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. And it could be that the other opinion agrees that it is a more beautiful way of fulfilling the mitzvah. So again, we mentioned last time, briefly, but now that we're at the topic, that technically you can tie them together with anything. Because there is an opinion also that it has to be specifically from these species. You have to use a myrtle or a lulav leaf to tie them together. But Lemaisa, we hold that you could even tie them together with a string because it's not a chatzitza, because it's in order to beautify the mitzvah. In order to beautify the mitzvah, when something is there in order to beautify something, so it's not considered an inappropriate barrier. It's like nail polish for a woman, right?
really?
Controversial topic, but... Yeah, maker adin, that's why if a woman has full nail polish that's not chipped or and it's exactly the way she wants it, so that's not a chatzitza if she goes to the mikvah because she wants it there, it's in order to beautify her.
It's
so,
not. Do all the mikvah ladies know this?
I mean, it's not in accordance with the minhag, that we have a very strong minhag that a woman... whenever physically possible, does not go into the mikvah with anything foreign on her body whatsoever. That's the very strong minhag. But according to halacha, absolutely full nail polish is not considered a chatzitza to go for the mikvah because, again, it's something that you want there. It's to beautify you, and it's not considered an inappropriate barrier. That's like if the mikvah lady was on drugs or something and a woman managed to get into the mikvah with nail polish and she forgot to take it off herself, then she goes home and she doesn't have to go back to the mikvah afterwards because it's not a chatzitza. But if mikvah ladies are so, correctly so, more stringent than what is technically true according to the halacha. Again, if a woman says...
My rabbi said.
Right, if a woman says, obviously, this is a tremendous chutzpah. But if a woman would say something like, says to the rabbi, if you don't let me go into the mikvah with my nail polish, so I'm not going to go to the mikvah at all. So, in former times when the Jewish community had more authority, so you could excommunicate her or something like that for saying something so chutzpahdik. But nowadays, when such a thing is not possible, so then the wise thing would be to instruct the mikvah lady to let her go into the mikvah with nail polish. Okay? But that's the same principle over here, that you're allowed to tie the lulav together with any thing, even a string.
A nice ribbon, though, not a regular string.
It could be a string because it's considered be'etzem to make the lulav prettier. Yeah. But tying the lulav together... Yeah. is something that Be'etzem makes them prettier, although, yeah, use a nice string. Although the minhag is, the truth is, to tie it together with the lulav leaves anyway, to use the same species so that it should not even more give more strength to the idea that it's not an appropriate barrier.
Are you talking about just tying the lulav or tying the lulav with the arovas and
the... Tying the lulav with the arovas and the hadasim. That you're supposed to... again, we paskin lulav ein tzarech eged, that if it doesn't have any tie around it at all, you're still yotze. Although you should still certainly pick all four up at the same time, ideally. But, so we hold that ideally you're supposed to tie a double knot. That's supposed to be a double knot. And we also hold, in contrast to Charlie's psak, that we hold that the koishikol, the little handle thingy, is considered to be like a double knot. And because it holds them together very strongly, and that is an acceptable method of doing eged.
And the advantage of actually using what's called
Koishikol.
Koishikol, okay, right. Is in fact you so can when you're done with it, you can take the arovos and the hadassim out and put them in the refrigerator, which you couldn't do with the whole lulav.
That's true.
In fact, the whole thing were
That's true. Mm-hmm.
The lulav doesn't fit in most refrigerators.
The lulav doesn't fit in most. It also doesn't need to be refrigerated for the most part.
Right.
The hadassim and the arovos, should ideally be refrigerated. Although even with refrigeration, it's extremely likely that your arovos will not last the entire. Holiday. Expect to need to buy new arovos halfway through the holiday. Maybe twice. Depends how fresh and pretty you want them looking. But do not expect your arovos to last the entire holiday. That's why many people, by the end of the holiday, a lot of times you're going to see people with arovos that are very questionably kosher, if at all, because maybe they didn't store them properly at all. But even if they did, they just don't last that long. So...
By the way, you do take the arovos and the hadassim in and out of the camp. Some of the leaves could get rubbed off at the bottom. Is that a problem at all? Or is that
It could be if most of the leaves fall off. Could be a problem. If a few leaves fall off, it's not a problem. But if it, sometimes I found that also. Once I thought my arovos were still good, but then I took it out of the tying together the bundle, and I saw there were just a couple leaves on it. So I rent to buy new ones. If you're in a shul, in most shuls they have hadassim and arovos. Hadassim you usually don't need to replace. Sometimes yes, but hadassim and arovos they usually have for sale at the shul. And again, you should expect to buy them. Some people have this idea that I'm only buying one. This is my headset for the holiday. There are some people who replace the arovos every day, so they should be super fresh. That such a minhag is brought in the halachic svarim. So yeah. Expect to change it. That's why some people, you see, with a similar idea, people have this weird sentimental attachment to their original mitzvah items, that sometimes you see people, 50-year-old man, and his ritzuas of his tefillin are completely worn out, shot, peeling, and, you say, why don't you just get new ones? No, these are my tefillin. I got them for my bar mitzvah. These are my tefillin. I'm not changing them. Everyone should expect to change their tefillin ritzuas occasionally. Maybe it's every 10 years, maybe it's every 20 years. What? The straps, yeah. But
hey, that old story. I have the original axe that George Washington used to chop down the cherry tree.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it's had three new handles and four new heads, but it's
still
the original one.
Yeah, but you should, you should expect to buy new of these things, which can and do wear out.
Is there any halacha about...